they're getting us right where we need to be, and I think that's it. All right, today is a continuation of yesterday, the series that is Eat for Today and for the Future. So we're going to begin today. We have a lot of material to cover, and so hopefully we can get all going. If you have questions, also receive them at the end so we can answer every question you may have.
And don't forget to sign if you want us to send you material, and grab one of these if you want one of these. So today we're going to talk about, we're just going to talk about some of the other people that are talking about plant-based whole food diet. It's not just us. There's actually a strong movement going on. And one of the main people that has promoted this is Dr. T. Colin Campbell. He has over 50 years worth of nutrition research, and he is a person of who didn't really come to it with any bias. His bias was actually against eating plants. His bias was towards protein and trying to get a protein source, and he grew up on a dairy farm, so he didn't have any bias towards vegetarianism or whole food plant-based, but he came through the evidence that he found working in the field of nutrition, and he is a nutrition researcher. I did happen to take the Cornell e-University plant-based nutrition certificate program last year, so I've learned a lot from him. He also wrote the book Whole, which I recommend. That really shows how reductionistic Western scientific thought has hindered the progress of nutrition research, because if you take the whole apple, it is working in synergy. The nutrients are working there together, not just taking one nutrient out, which is what nutrition research has been over the years, is looking at one nutrient, like zinc, one mineral, one nutrient, and looking at the effects of one. But if you have the whole food, it's working in synergy together, not just one taking out one from the whole. Dr. John McDougall has done a lot to promote a whole food plant-based diet. This is one of his latest books, The Healthiest Diet on the Planet. And I have these books in my office. I point to these books when I'm talking to my patients, because I'm telling them, you know, I'm not the only crazy doctor giving you this advice. Because I have had patients who I tell this to, and they go out to their own doctor. Like, for example, I had one mother who asked advice from the doctor that she works with at his office, and they were all saying, oh no, you can't take away protein from a 12-year-old growing boy who's already obese, because, you know, if you take out all the animal products, you're taking out all the protein, obviously. So I look to these doctors who've really done a lot to promote the whole food plant-based. Dr. Neil Bernard also, he has written several books. We mentioned yesterday The Cheese Trap, which he wrote, and he also wrote Power Foods for the Brain, which I have not read yet. Also, Dr. Joel Fuhrman, he is promoting this as well, and he has several books in the bookstore. Dr. Esselstein is another champion. He demonstrated that a plant-based diet can reverse heart disease, and that attracted the attention of none other than Bill Clinton, who found that he had improvements and was reversing his cardiovascular disease and improving his health with a whole food plant-based diet. Dr. Esselstyn also says some people think that a plant-based diet is extreme, a whole food plant-based diet is extreme, but 500,000 people every year will have their chests opened and a vein taken from their leg and sewn into their coronary artery. Some people might call that extreme. So, also Dr. Michael Greger, who's the founder of NutritionFacts.org, he wrote How Not to Die, which is a book that I have read and have enjoyed. I was reading it on the plane, several trips on the plane, and got into discussions with people around me about the book. And people are very interested, especially young people. The millennial generation is very interested in whole food, plant-based lifestyle. Dr. Dean Ornish as well, he wrote Eat More, Weigh Less, and his program emphasizes whole foods, plant-based diet. Dr. Kim Allen Williams, who is the former president in 2015 of the American College of Cardiology, he said, there are two kinds of cardiologists, vegans and those who have not or haven't read the data. The data is clear, the research is clear. Whole food, plant-based is the way to go, no animal products. This is the Physician Committee for Responsible Medicine, started by Neil Bernard, based in Washington, D.C. They've actually sued the government to prevent misinformation in the education materials going with government monies. So like the dairy industry or the egg industry promoting their foods as healthy. He has been involved in lawsuits challenging that when they're actually saying falsehoods with the advertisement. So we have a lot to thank for him. He's doing a lot of work with that. And a lot of young doctors are jumping on board with the whole food plant-based movement. If you're interested in a plant-based doctor near you, you can go to the Plant-Based Docs website and look up all the plant-based doctors in your area. So this is not a fringe idea anymore. So again, we're going to continue with eating for today and your future. And we were talking about yesterday, nutrients for the brain, and we left off around avoiding toxins from animal products. And another toxin that we have not talked about yet is trimethylamine oxide. And animal products basically cause the formation of trimethylamine oxide. And I will show you right here how that is. This is when you're eating animal products, including eggs and cheese, you are fostering certain bacteria in your intestines. Those bacteria are primed to change choline, which is an animal product, to trimethylamine. That is right here. So you're taking phosphatidylcholine in the animal products, and that is changed to trimethylamine. Trimethylamine is as my husband said, is a nasty molecule. So it is detoxified somewhat by the liver into trimethylamine oxide, so it's added an oxygen group there. And trimethylamine oxide is also an oxidizer. Remember we talked about yesterday how you need antioxidants because you have oxidants in your body that's released, and these are takers. These are going to damage your DNA, and you need antioxidants to detoxify these. So these is directly causing arteriosclerosis. The entire vasculature, as we talked about yesterday, is affected by this. And there is one inhibitor of this whole process, and it's called dimethylaminobutene, and it's found in things like vinegar and grapeseed oil, and it inhibits this process. But I would think it's better just not to eat any of this, then you don't have any of this, right? The entire vasculature gets arteriosclerosis, right? So it's starting in these little tiny capillaries, and you need this brain tissue. So you don't want to be clogging up your arteries with trimethylamine oxide. Next, another thing coming from animal products is advanced glycation end products, or AGEs. AGEs age you. That's just the bottom line. They cause cell damage, degeneration, diseases, high sugar, high fat, high meat. This is where they come from. So high sugar, high fat, high heat foods have advanced glycation end products. Advanced glycation end products go to the cells and they cause reactions in the cells. And eventually your body makes a defense against that, and that leads to vascular calcification or hardening of the arteries. So AGEs age you. What has AGEs? What are the contents of certain foods? The highest on this list, with 6,000, over 6,000, is stir-fried beef. You can see those that are things that are broiled have higher AGEs than those things that are boiled. So 2,000 in the boiled beef. When you have apples here that are only 13 AGEs, and then compared to French fries, which is 1,500. So the higher the heat, and the higher the fat, the more AGEs, the more sugar content also, and the higher the heat, the more AGEs. AGEs have been linked to amyloidosis, which is Alzheimer's disease. You don't have to read the article. It's just pointing out that this is in the literature. Advanced glycation end products contribute to Alzheimer's disease. Also contributes to diabetes-related depression. So in the first day, we talked about the hippocampus. It's part of the brain, hippocampal function. This is damaged by advanced glycation end products. So with the Ministry of Healing, if you turn to page 122, and if you read that chapter, 122, starting on page 122, Diet and Health, and then the next chapter, which is the dangers of flesh foods, you'll kind of have, you know, one of the things that is a great blessing to our church. Because just like tobacco, and Ellen White telling us that tobacco is bad for us and was way ahead of the science, the science actually has been way ahead than more, how did I say that? The science has been suppressed. Let's put it that way. The science on plant-based nutrition has been purposely suppressed by the animal product industry. If you read The Cheese Trap by Neil Barnard, chapter 8, I read chapter 8, and I happened to have some time at work, a patient canceled or something, didn't show up, and I read that chapter. I got angry because it's intentional suppression of the truth that is really killing people. And so, but we are so blessed to have this information that we maybe sometimes don't review enough. I know in, if you look at the dangers of flesh foods, I reread it recently, and we're going to show you a video tomorrow that I wrote. I wrote the script for the video, taking part of the chapter on flesh foods in the video. So you can look forward to seeing our video tomorrow. But so you can read it for yourself, starting on page 122. There's three chapters on nutrition there in the book Ministry of Healing. So, nutrients for the brain, we're going to next talk about the omega-3 and the omega-6 fatty acids.
Okay, ready for the discussion on omega fatty acids, because there has been so much out there on the discussion. So, the last portion of our summarized nutrients for the brain takes us to the omegas, the omega fatty acids. All of you have heard about the omega fatty acids, right? Who hasn't? Now, we're gonna explain it to you, break it down. So this is a very, very important portion of our talk, because it leads to, it's the bridge between the nutrition and disease. More or less saying that what the type of fatty acids actually can influence the onset of disease. Now, why are omega fatty acids important? Omega fatty acids are part of cell membranes. That means, in this graph, this is a cell membrane. These are phospholipids, which every animal cell membrane has, including the humans. And so every cell has these. There's a population of fatty acids. In red, we have the omega-6 fatty acids. In yellow, we have the omega-3 fatty acids. Notice that the ratio in this picture is quite similar, right? You see the same amount of yellow, which is the omega-3s, with the same amount of red, which is omega-6, so it's nicely depicted in balance. And the omega fatty acids are very important components of the cell membrane, provide fluidity along with cholesterol in the right amounts, so make the cell membrane very healthy and fluid. And so the cell membrane has to be in this consistency always for good signaling, the anchoring of receptors and factors that provide the cell with the communication with the external world. So let's talk about the polyunsaturated fatty acids known as PUFA or PUFA. We're going to talk about the two most common biologically active fatty acids, such as omega-3s and omega-6. The omega-3s are known as omega-3s because the double bonds here between carbons and red start at carbon number 3, hence the name omega-3s. And usually there's about 3 to 5 double bonds in this chain of the fatty acid. And so they can be, they can have about 20 to 21 carbons. They get metabolized and so forth. And we'll show you that in a minute. The omega-6 are known as omega-6 because they start the double bonds at what position? At carbon 6. So that is basically the chemistry and the nomenclature for these fatty acids. Now, something very important about these two types of fatty acids, do not forget, by the way, that we also have omega-9s and omega-12s. Omega-9s are also exist in some oils, but they are not as biologically active, but we do get them from diet too, at a very small quantities. Okay, let's talk about the omega-6 fatty acids, the one in the bottom. They are essential. What do we mean by essential? That we must get them in the diet. So we don't create those. We don't make those fatty acids. We have to get them from the foods we eat. There are two types right here where the pointer is, linoleic acid and arachidonic acid. Arachidonic acid is a precursor for a group of metabolites that elicit or increase inflammation. So there's a red flag going up now. Is inflammation good? It is only good if it's acutely elicited. But if it's sustained, it's not good. So if somebody asks you, what do you think of inflammation? I think I want to avoid it. Well, if it lasts you, again, 24 to 48 hours, thumbs up. That is the way of, by which your organism is fighting infection. Okay, so that's a very aggressive response, and you have to rest. Allow your immune system to take care of. What happens if after 48 hours you still have high fever? Symptoms of this generalized illness, then you must see the doctor. Okay? So a sustained inflammation is not good. Chronic inflammation, not good. Acute inflammation, okay. All right? I hope I'm conveying that. However, from the diet, arachidonic acid tends to elicit metabolites that sustain inflammation. That, hence, is not good. That is why. But I'll explain that in more detail. The other group is the omega-3 fatty acids are also essential. They're essential because we must get them from the diet. Now, notice the abbreviation, the three letters for omega-3s and the two letters for omega-6. The three letters here are for alpha-linolenic acid, eicosapentaenoic acid, EPA, and docosahexaenoic acid, DHA. When you go to the store, now that we're telling you this, please pay attention to the abbreviations because some foods would have these abbreviations. You know that if you only look at two, it says the fatty acids is a two-letter, the flag should go up and you said, I'm getting an omega-6 product here. Now, you're going to have a mixture, okay? You're going to have a mixture of both fatty acids, but you want to get more of this. I'll explain what I mean by that. More omega-3s than omega-6, I'll explain that. But you get both in the diet. You cannot avoid this, okay? Keep that in mind. Just know that usually the abbreviations for omega-3s will be three letters and are three letters, and for the omega-6 are usually two letters, okay? Okay. Something very important that omega-3s, let's talk about the omega-3s since I'm leaning towards the benefit of omega-3s. Omega-3 fatty acids have anti-inflammatory actions in the brain, so it wouldn't make sense that you want to get lots of this to counter some effects of this. That doesn't make sense. So it would make sense, and it does make sense. As I said, omega fatty acids integrate themselves in the cell membrane, are part of the cell membrane, come from the diet, and their metabolism creates these metabolites that become SPMs. What are SPMs? They're specialized pro-resolving mediators of inflammation. That is a mouthful. Hence, I'm just going to say SPMs. But SPMs, as pro-resolving mediators, means this. Exactly what it means, mediators or resolvers. What do we understand for resolving resolvers? Resolvers means that it resolves an activation. Every inflammation process, every inflammatory process must come down. It doesn't have to stay on. So the cell or the organism, when it gets inflamed, increases that inflammatory curve, and then it decreases and recedes, and you feel fine again. That is the way to go. This metabolized from the omega fatty acid, from the omega-3s, do exact that. They produce SPMs that help the cell to resolve the inflammatory episode. Is that understood? Okay, so that's what they're good. And this is the result of vast amount of research. Dr. Serhan, a noted scientist, had developed this about 15 years ago, and he took off with this, now is well established. Now, omega-3 fatty acids, notice that there's a fish oil, and I'll comment about that, as an anti-inflammatory, is an alternative for non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. As a matter of fact, this has been used now in the clinical setting as a treatment to help inflammatory responses to calm down, to to recede or to resolve. Now, you may ask, fish oil. Now, many of you have heard that we find the omega-3s in fish oil, have you? This is not new. But think about this. Just as the bad things get concentrated in the tissues of animals, remember we said that yesterday? The good things also get concentrated in the flesh of animals. Where does fish get the omega-3s from? Algae, thank you. So algae is the organic source of omega-3s. Now, why not get omega-3s from the source as opposed to have the fish? Because the fish also eats some not so good stuff, right? So it diminishes the positive actions of the omega-3s. But a lot of people will recommend and tell you, hey, get those capsules with the omega-3. Have you heard that? Some fish oil. The caveat is that because of these double bonds, the omega-3s tends to get oxidized. They won't last long. Why? Because this double bonds, chemically speaking, are prone to oxidation. And when you take an oxidized product, you're not taking basically something healthy. You're providing your organism with more oxidative stress. That is why it's best to get it in the organic form. That's one of the explanations. All this obeys to how complex the metabolism of fatty acid is in the body. Here's a map. Look at that map. I will walk you through, and you'll see how understandable this is. So my pointer now is on the linoleic acid, LA. Okay. Linoleic acid. This is an omega-6. Remember the two-letter abbreviation? So when you see a two-letter abbreviation, that's a what? Omega-6. This is the, on the other arm, on the right is the ALA. That's an A, omega-3. Both that are precursors would get metabolized by an enzyme known as delta-6 desaturase. So this enzyme allows these two fatty acids to proceed to their metabolic chains or synthesis. And so, synthetic chains or metabolic chains. Now, on this side, we have that linoleic acid would be metabolized. It yields arachidonic acid, another omega-6. And on this side, it will lead to EPA. Then these two chains, this metabolic chains, would utilize other key enzymes. And this is impacted by the omega-6 to 3 ratio. How many of you have heard this? The ratio of omegas. Great. So I'm explaining this and reviewing this so we are clear on this, and I will touch on that. What are the food sources of each? Mind you that this enzyme gets shifted towards each of these. If you get a lot of omega-3s, the enzyme would actually use it as substrate and warp for this arm. What happens if we eat more of the omega-6? Where does the enzyme tilt its action towards? The left. Doesn't that make sense? So that is why the balance that we put into these two metabolic chains is important. And so what are the sources? Let's go to the sources. I'll develop this idea a little more. Sources for omega-6 are soybean oil, safflower oil, corn oil. I have said that the body needs both, and I'll make a point of that. However, some diets have a lot more concentration of omega-6 than 3s. I'll point that out too. Now, these are the oils that tend to have more omega-6 content. Also, these are the foods that have a high content of arachidonic acid. Remember what arachidonic acid produces? Inflammation, right? Sustained inflammation I'm talking about. Eggs and chicken. Those are two foods. Now let's go on the other arm. This is the omega-3 arm. And those that are rich in omega-3s are leafy greens, walnuts, chia seeds. And those also that are rich in EPA, very good omega-3s are breast milk and algae. Here are the organic sources of omega-3s. You may wonder about breast milk. Breast milk is, it's basically, has a high concentration of omega-3s. So make sure that you spread this around, because a lot of moms need to give their kids the best source of omega-3s, and it's found in breast milk. And algae here, remember what the fish eat, and therefore there it is in organic form. DHA is found in great concentrations in these, in these three tissues, testes, the brain, and the retina. We need DHA for retina, for the function of the retina, and a lot of times as we age, we need to get more of the omega-3s to help the vision. The brain needs it and uses it because of the membrane. My membrane needs it, and the testes also. All right. Unfortunately, in the U.S., the omega-6 fatty acid consumption in our population among us has steadily increased since the 1960s. Notice this figure is representative to the to 2010. Notice that linear increase in omega-6 fatty acids. This is quite staggering. Here's a chimpanzee as a comparison. The chimpanzee is just the omega-6 fatty, the omega-6 intake has remained steadily at a flat line. What is the diet of a chimpanzee, by the way? What does a chimpanzee normally eat? Plants, that's what he eats. His omega-6 remains steady through the years. No population of them have changed. So that's the comparison. As I said, both omega fatty acids are good, but we need to balance them in our diet. The omega-6 is good, but we usually get enough. Keep that in mind. We get enough of omega-6 in the diet already. The omega-3s, both of the biologically, most biologically active, the EPA and DHA, are, the EPA is good, but we need to make sure to get enough. Sometimes we don't get enough, some foods provide. The DHA particularly is important for brain and visual development. So where can we get this? I don't know if I put chia seeds right there. Yes. How many of you have tried chia seeds, by the way? Very good. That's a good source to get chia seeds. Also, some other sources that we can find in nuts, legumes. Flax seed is another source of omega-3s. I'm sure some of you know where the good sources for omega-3s are. Now, the message here is clear. We need to balance, we need a balanced diet of fatty acids. The significance is staggering. Here we have an increase in the American diet. Unfortunately, we tend to get more pro-inflammatory than anti-inflammatory omega-3s. And this is not just only omnivores. This is vegetarians, vegans, across the table, we tend to ingest more omega-6. The evidence is clear. We need to balance that intake. So here, a meta-analysis showed that omega-3 preparations made of 60% of EPA were effective for depression. And this was a high-power study that actually was a groundbreaking report that led to all these subsequent studies now that are abundant in the literature. Now, let me tell you something. What is a perfect ratio then? I've been talking to you about the ratio that we must balance. What do you guys think is a perfect ratio? Any guesses? So let me show you. There's a question. What is the best ratio? So let us summarize in a contextual form. Vegetable oils in general are high in omega-6. The standard American diet is on average 30 to 1 omega-6 to omega-3 ratio. That is the average. This is way too much. The brain needs a 2 to 1 or 1 to 1 ratio. Remember the picture that I showed you a few slides ago? That nice membrane with an equal number, well, relatively equal number of omega-6 and omega-3s in red and yellow? That's what we should get in our brains. And that's what we suggest here. This is demonstrated by the literature and supported by the literature, the scientific literature and clinical as well. The high omega-6 levels lead to high arachidonic acid. And this is reviewing again, high arachidonic acid levels equals inflammation. High arachidonic acid levels also turns on an enzyme that breaks down serotonin and tryptophan. Serotonin is the neurotransmitter that counters or is the effects of depression and the brain. So arachidonic acid, too much omega-6, shunts that action, or I'm sorry, it prevents the action of serotonin by also breaking it down. That's basically what we're talking about. It breaks down serotonin and its precursor, tryptophan. In blue, these are things that help this process, helps this metabolic chain to form, but omega-6 fatty acids do a number in degrading these elements, these molecules, especially serotonin and tryptophan. And this is supported by the literature because experiments have shown that when people were given tryptophan deficient diet, that means very little tryptophan or deficient diet in this case, they became what? Irritable, annoyed, angry, and depressed. And this has been shown. So, whenever you are eating, always keep in mind the effects of omega-6 on mood. Omega-6 on the long term, that ratio, that imbalance in the ratio can be conducive to mood disorders, and Rhoda will talk about this pretty shortly. So let me ask you, are you omegas in balance? Omega-3s, omega-6, are they in balance? So these are important for depression. So let's talk about this in terms of depression with a few more studies.
So just to introduce the topic of depression, major depressive disorder is you can think of it as thoughts, feelings, behaviors, how your mind works, emotions, depression. Major depressive disorders, you feel bad, then you might have some negative thoughts, and that could also lead to negative behaviors. So thoughts, feelings, and behaviors are all connected. Just to illustrate how depression works a lot of times is you start to feel down, then you might have some negative thoughts. A lot of times we call these automatic negative thoughts, such as, I'm no good, I'm never good at anything, nothing will work out for me. Then you might have some not so healthy behaviors, such as staying in bed, not being as social as you normally would. And then you have possibly more negative emotion. So it can actually pull you down to a negative vortex, and it's like a ditch that you can't get out of. So when you are depressed, if you've had depression, which 20% of adults, or 20% likelihood, one in four people is going to have depression at some time in their life. So this is a very common disorder, major depressive disorder. And once you get in that ditch, your brain has physical changes. And as we talked about Sunday, you get lower BDNF levels and your brain actually shrinks, right? So I usually talk about with my patients how this is a physical change that happens in the brain. Just like if you have a heart attack, you have a physical change happen in your heart, it's a physical change that happens in your brain, right? So you don't necessarily just get out of that on your own. You're in a ditch and you can't necessarily get out on your own. So it is important to seek medical attention, to get help from professionals to, you know, help you out of the ditch. It's okay to ask for help. Sometimes it's interpreted as, well, if I have a heart attack, then I need to go to the doctor. But if I'm depressed, I don't need to go to the doctor. But, you know, it's an organ in your body, your brain. So depression is noticeably different on functional MRI. You can see in a depressed patient, on average, the brain is not working the same as a non-depressed patient. And you get that decrease in connectivity in the brain, so there are real physical changes that happen. But what causes these physical changes? What contributes to these physical changes? Well, one of those things is the inflammation that can happen. So starting with the food that we're eating here, this is your intestine, this is the lumen, the space in your intestines, and these are the bacteria here. And depending on what you're eating, you might be supporting some not so healthy bacteria. And this starts to break down the barrier between the lumen of the intestines and the blood supply here. And some of these bacteria can get through. They start to activate the immune system, which then causes an activation of the hypothalamic pituitary axis here. And then you get the cascade of the stress response, the increased inflammation. So inflammation in your gut leads to inflammation in your brain. So this is a real physical thing that's happening. There are emotional and psychological aspects to depression, but there are real physical aspects. And with this inflammation, again, you're breaking down more tryptophan, and then you're not getting as much serotonin, which is a neurotransmitter that transmits signals in your brain. So sustained inflammation in the gut turns off the molecular switches in the hippocampus. And the hippocampus is here. It's responsible for putting new memories in. Often when you have a severely depressed patient, they, when they get better especially, they often do not remember a lot of the events during their depression. And that is because the hippocampus is not functioning correctly. And we have a decrease in neurogenesis. We talked about that on Sunday as well. Neurogenesis being the growth of new neurons. And so on a molecular level, this is just a, and you don't have to, I'm sorry that you probably can't see all these little things here, but this is a blow up of what's happening in one cell in the brain, specifically in the hippocampus, when you have this inflammation that is turning off the brain-derived neurotrophic factor production. And these are all the intricate molecular things that are happening just right there in the cell. So you don't have to memorize that, but you just know that things are happening that are leading to less neurogenesis and thus causing a physical change in the brain, which leads to depression, causes inflammation and inhibits the brain-derived neurotrophic factor, reducing neurogenesis. Vegetarian diets have been shown to and are associated with a healthier mood. This is a study done on Seventh-day Adventists, and it showed, and you don't have to read that, obviously you can't, but what it's showing is that vegetarian diets are associated with a healthier mood. So this is taking Adventists who are omnivores and comparing them to vegetarian Adventists. And what it's showing here is that for women, the effect is even greater than for men. So on the measure of depression here, this is the omnivore women have higher measures of depression than the vegetarian women. And then the omnivore men have higher than the vegetarian men, higher depression scores. And for females here. This is another measure of mood states. So it's even better for women than for men to have a vegetarian diet, at least in this particular study. So just to go over some studies quite rapidly, and I've just listed them here. The reference is not so big, but the reference is not so important as the fact that fruit and vegetables have been shown to be protective against depression. And we have a video, hopefully we can play it, that shows you a little bit more why that is. Restricted meat and fish and poultry improves mood. That was reported in 2012. Vegans report less stress and anxiety than omnivores. This was a study in nutritional neuroscience in 2014. And polyphenols, which are natural compounds found to fight mental illness in 2012, were, if you're eating more plants, more of the polyphenols, you're going to have less mental illness. And then plants have compounds that act like antidepressants. So monoamine oxidase inhibitors, MAOIs, are a older antidepressant that sometimes is still used today. But the compound quercetin found in certain fruits and vegetables have an MAOI effect. So you can get your antidepressant from eating lots of fruits and vegetables. And this is one study that was published in 2009. It shows the long-term effects of a low-carbohydrate diet versus a low-fat diet. So low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet versus... So this was a prospective study. They're putting them on this diet for 1 year. And again, this graph is too small for you to read, but I just put it up there to illustrate that in every category of vitality and mood, the low-fat diet did better than the low-carb diet. And that's a year study. So just to wrap up, yesterday we did all the negatives on cheese. Now we're going to do the negatives on eggs. Eggs, when they're cooked, they form heterocyclic amines, and these equal more degenerative disease and cancer. Animal protein in the body causes acidosis, which equals more advanced glycation end products. One egg is the same amount of cholesterol as a Big Mac. So that, you just think about that for a minute. More eggs equals more heart disease. And then more eggs equals more cancer. And eggs have the trimethylamine oxidase, trimethylamine oxide promoting, just like meat. Finally, one egg in one research study, this was done to show that one egg a day is equal to 5 cigarettes a day for 15 years. So, you know, we might want to consider whether that egg really is so important. Now, I did promise to go over some things out of this book. It's called The Pleasure Trap. And it's not a Christian book. It's based on evolution. So, you know, you have to keep that in mind if you're reading it. But it does have some good points in it, so I thought I would go over that. So one of the things is that satiation idea. So when you are eating a highly processed food diet with animal products, and you see the oil here, oil, 500 calories worth of oil is only going to fill you up this much, right? And then 500 calories of cheese, this much. And then 500 calories of meat, it's a little bit more. And then 500 calories of potatoes, rice, and beans, it's got a little bit more bulk there. And then, of course, fruits and vegetables is the most satiating of all in terms of stretching your stomach. So when we're thinking about a whole food plant-based diet, we're actually able to eat more food and feel more satiated and more satisfied. And I personally have found if I'm eating a lot of potatoes, rice, beans, veggies, and I'm eating enough of them, I'm not craving other foods. So you really do have to eat more food if you're considering changing to a whole food plant-based. But that's always a good thing. I tell my patients, you should eat more, not less, right? So another good concept that has helped me a lot in when I'm talking to people about changing their diet, which I am doing, by the way, almost every day, sometimes 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 times a day, it depends on how open people are. But I show them this. So you probably aren't gonna be able to read all this down here. That's okay, I'm gonna explain it, okay? So what this is the pleasure zone. So it shows that you have a normal pleasure zone here. So most of the, so I just, you know, start out with talking about drugs because most people understand that. So you're in a normal pleasure zone. You're getting normal pleasure from normal daily activities like a job well done. You get that hit of dopamine in the nucleus accumbens of your brain that hits the normal pleasure center. So that keeps you going in life, you know, sex and eating and all that hits normal pleasure zone, typically if you're, you know, doing that within reason. And then if you take something like cocaine, you are going to enhance that pleasure. So you're gonna feel enhanced pleasure with the cocaine initially, you know, over some months. But then your brain is going to adapt and the cocaine is going to feel the same as normal pleasure to you. So you have to get that, you have to get that fix, that drug, just to feel normal pleasure in life. And then when you go off the drug, you're going to go into the subnormal pleasure zone for a while because your brain has to adapt. So you have to have that period of abstinence from the drug. And then your brain's going to adapt and then you're going to be back in the normal pleasure zone without the drug. This is the same exact thing with food. So unfortunately, many of my patients are born or raised in an enhanced pleasure zone. They're constantly eating animal products, high fat, high sugar, high salt foods that are actually enhanced pleasure. But their brain has already adapted so that they feel like this is normal pleasure, right? And so they're feeling normal pleasure from these highly stimulating type of foods. So when anyone tries to go off of these highly stimulated type of foods, you are going to go into a withdrawal state. You are going to feel less pleasure. But just like with drugs, you have to go through that so that your brain can adapt. So I find a lot of times people don't actually go through this. They are constantly getting that enhanced pleasure from something they're eating. So their brain is never going to adapt if they're doing that. So that's why I recommend to patients to try to, if they're going to try it, this is what I often say, is what percentage of your life is 1 month? What percentage of your whole life is 1 month? If you never give yourself a chance to feel better, you know, then you will never know how you could feel differently. So they never actually, or a lot of people never actually give themselves a chance to adapt to a whole food, plant-based diet. But then it's going to feel like normal pleasure once you do that. And you might find that you have some health benefits. And then it might be worth it to you to stay on that whole food, plant-based diet. Just one example comes to mind with my sister and her husband, who have recently decided to do this. And when they've been on it for a while, and then they decided to, like my brother-in-law, he decided to, he was really craving a cheese something biscuit or something or other, egg biscuit. And he went there and he got the biscuit and he said it tasted terrible, right? So it left the grease, you know, like, and this is a person who has eaten this way his whole life. Like, he has eaten high fat, highly processed food his whole life. So it was a really miracle, actually, that happened. So, anyway, give yourself a chance, right? So, yeah.
Well, thank you. I think we have reached to a very culminating point in the nutrition. There's so much information, we can't even begin. So Rhoda had the chance to tell you the links between nutrition and depression, which we actually have a seminar series for that alone, because there's so much information out there that we haven't even touched here. There's so many things, nutrition, psychological aspects, experiential, and so forth. So I'm gonna open for questions right now, and Rhoda and I will try to answer them. There's a couple of hands going up here and another one here. So wait for your turn. Yes.
In that last chart, so you're saying that the person's actually going to feel...
The person is actually going to feel worse before they feel better, right? So kind of have that in mind when you're going through that process, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. My other question is, when you listed all the oils that causes... that are omega-6. I had a question about sunflower oil. That's a vegetable oil, so it would fall under omega-6, right? So is sunflower oil inflammatory?
So I would say all oil is inflammatory. It's better to eat the whole sesame seed, the whole food. Because, I mean, like you said, once you take the oil out, when it's in the whole food, it's preventing the breakdown. It's preventing the oxidation.
Right.
Once you take it out of the whole food, it's starting to break down already. So, like most fish oils, for example, are already starting to be rancid by the time you buy them from the store. It's kind of the same with all oil. They're unstable. So it's better not to eat any of the oil.
There are two things with your question that I'm getting is, one, you asked if the sunflower oil is inflammatory. We have a chart that we found where it breaks down overall in the even vegetables, and the omega-6 tend to be the most abundant. So we cannot escape from that fact. It's just the nature of the plant. That's why, I mean, from the oils, we're talking about oils. Most oils have a high content of omega-6. That is why we are suggesting to decrease the intake of oil, and Rhoda is very adamant and says, no, we have to decrease the intake of oils because the nature of oils is to have more omega-6 than omega-3s. And the other one is what Rhoda already answered, you know, that when you process the oils further, they have to add other additives to maintain, to keep it in a good form so it can last on the shelf. It can, you know, we can use it for longer periods of time. And though both the substances, we don't know what effects they have, and they sometimes combine and they stay in our system producing some inflammation also.
So then, like in a salad, like we normally would have oil, you know, lemon juice or vinegar people have. So what can we do, like, for our salads? You know, do we, how do we substitute that? Like, give us, like, an idea how to put it in a practical form.
So I, before I went to the conference in September, Sam would make this, like, olive oil and lime dressing, and I would use a lot. He would tell me I was using too much. But what I got used to it now, just the lime only, not the oil.
So we're eliminating oil completely. Mm-hmm. It's better to eliminate, not to have any at all.
Yeah. Dr. Esselstein, in his talks, if you look up Dr. Esselstein and you watch his YouTube talk, he says, no oil. No oil. Because basically he is saying that, well, he has said that oil is the killer of vegans.
So can we do like nuts, like use nuts and make a dressing or something with nuts?
Yeah, so the whole food, like tahini is okay.
We're discovering that oils and other nutrients in whole food forms are the way to go. Why? Because the research time after time is scientists are trying to find flaws of the whole plant, you know, of the whole food. And every time they just slam their heads and says, oh boy, yeah, they need to be in a whole form to be beneficial. And that's the same case for the oils.
And the information you shared is fabulous to prove that, you know, why we need to. My last question is in regards to seeds and nuts, there's a big hype now about hemp seeds. Is there any pros, cons to it?
Omega 6.
I think they're high in omega 3.
They both.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I would advise.
It doesn't have the cannabinoids. The cannabinoid drug is what is making you high. So the hemp seed does not have. So hemp actually doesn't have the cannabinoids that are going to make you high.
Try to balance overall. I think that would be the message here. Yeah.
What about avocados?
Avocados?
Fine.
So, yeah, that's a whole food.
Some oil.
So that's a whole food.
But to eat the avocado rather than the oil?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
By all means,
not the oil.
And is that an omega 3?
I'm not sure the content of omega-3.
It's a mixture, actually.
It's going to have a mixture.
It's going to have a mixture of both omega-6 and omega-3s. And so, yeah, most of them are kind of a mixture. Some foods, some plants. Any other, right here, yes.
What about tahini? I know that's...
that's ground sesame seeds.
Right.
I think
that's okay.
I think that's okay. I mean, eating the sesame seed is probably better, but
tahini and lemon makes a really incredible dressing.
Yes. Yeah.
There's one caveat that it's impossible to escape, that society we live in presents you with this. Do not be surprised that the industry, food industries, are up with the literature. They have to be, because they capitalize. So let's say a company hears a tahini being good, and so there they go, package it, sell it. But in order to do that, they have to make it last. That is what the problem is that we didn't talk about today. A lot of these preservatives, molecules that are designed to preserve foods, do a number on the brain that people don't know, they haven't even begun to study. But I bet you there are some effects that we don't know of, and the incidence of autism, it's one of them. Why are the autism incidence is increasing exponential, as we showed you?
What about the plastic in the food?
There was one research, thanks for reminding me. So there was one preservative that I was trying to, in collaboration with another fellow, to design a way to measure fatty acids on the cells. And we were just designing this, and we went to the literature to see if somebody had done it, and I accidentally came on a piece of literature that said that pizza had they actually put in this silicone-based preservative to make the cheese bubble and look more delicious. And when I Googled that particular, well, I went into the literature to look for that particular molecule. That molecule does not dissolve anywhere. It stays in your body. And it's going to go to the brain. What is it going to do there? Imagine that. So I went to tell her, I go, can you believe this? And so there are a lot of molecules like this.
Yeah. A question. I was told earlier that cold-pressed oil would be the best to use, but now this the discovery is coming up that avoid all oil and do the natural base.
She went to that conference. I think you can answer that. I don't know what they commented.
The olives, not the oil, is really what they're saying. Eat the olives,
yeah.
Not the oil.
Go to the source. Just like the fish would eat the algae. Okay, let's go get some algae. I think it's the most, the more organic the source for a nutrient that you're looking for is, the better. I think that's the message that we're trying to convey. And I know, I understand, we both understand that it's so difficult nowadays because, boy, food industry really likes to package the goodies and make it more commercially, and then they put in more things. That's one thing to consider. I keep saying that again.
I'm thinking about Bible bread, and I'm thinking how oil was used in the bread. So is that okay, or are we to take, like, nuts, grind them up, make a liquid out of it, then put it into the bread? I'm just trying to figure out, you know, the balance here, you know. So do we make bread now with oil, or is oil gone from our bread now?
I think you can use a little bit. I don't know. I don't know what you say. She's convinced that we should cut oils. I'm saying use this curve right here.
Right. I mean, there's such a thing as really damaging, not as damaging, better, best, right? So, you know, if you're going to go with the best, I mean, if you have serious heart disease, I wouldn't, or any kind of brain disease, I wouldn't do the oil at all.
Yeah.
If you don't have that, maybe you don't have to be as careful. But, you know, if you want to do the best, I would say, you know, with bread, the Ezekiel bread doesn't have oil.
So I'm
pretty
bread.
Sure you can make bread without oil. I haven't done it, to be honest. I haven't done bread lately. I've been too busy. But
Ezekiel bread,
I usually get the
good.
Ezekiel bread. So.
And it's tasty, by the way. I don't know. The power of the brain is such that it would reprogram your taste, your affinity for food. We haven't talked about that today because we don't have time. But that's another, how the brain changes your affinity for foods that
well,
you
your
reset.
Taste buds even
that
change.
Taste buds change. The receptors that we have in our tongues change. And so, yes.
The interesting thing about this that you haven't mentioned yet is how the oil is treated in digestion. If it is in the food, like in the olive, it goes through the normal digestion in the stomach completely through. If it is a separated oil or a separated fat, then when it gets down to the stomach stops all of the digestion and works on that fat first. This means that your entire digestion of everything that is in the stomach right there may be dumped into the digestive system in the colon, partly digested because the fat was had to be worked on. And so this is the problem. This was recognized way back by John Harvey Kellogg in his book, The Itinerary of a Breakfast, also by Dr. Milton Crane and others at Weimar in their books over there that I have in my display. And so this thing has been recognized for a long time that the digestion is also a serious problem with the separated fat.
Thank you. Yeah, we didn't have time to talk on the physiology of how digestion happens, but that is very true. Thank you for adding it. And if you have any more thoughts about this, they're welcome. Indeed, I mean, protein gets digested in the stomach. We actually began digesting carbohydrates in the saliva because we have the enzymes there, the amylase. We have the acid in our cells there, and then the protein gets broken down with those acids in our stomach, and we put oil, guess what? We postpone and it delays a little bit. There's ample literature. We, you know, textbooks teach about this, so thank you for reminding us. It's just that the time at sometimes is a little bit contingent, but that is a very important point. Thank you.
I was in the Amish community up in Pennsylvania, and I had a wonderful natural food store. And the nurse there that was working there told me that now what's coming down in the information they're getting is they're saying that maybe real butter is better for the body than the oils.
Butter made of
butter. Butter is back. That's the Well, I do think there is a case that butter is better than margarine. Margarine is a trans fat.
Right.
So trans fats are a big cause of heart disease.
They're not naturally made. So
So trans fat means that the fat has been chemically altered,
right,
so that it is much worse for the body and the brain. A researcher at U of I is the one that has pushed this, and supposedly the trans fat will come out of the food supply. It's still there today, but I don't know what the goal is. What time frame do you remember? Trans fat stopping from the food supply?
Yeah, we don't know. There's a lot of politics, red tape going on right now, so it's very difficult to eradicate it. But
New York banned it.
It's coming up by states, yes. Yeah. And they have to say there that it's trans fat.
But butter does have saturated fat. So it's, again, a matter of, so trans fat is the worst. And actually, butter and other animal fats do have some trans fat in them. Naturally, so that's not good. And then butter is like the second worst. So I wouldn't say butter is good, but it's better than margarine, but that doesn't make it good.
Earth Balance is bad.
I threw away my Earth Balance. I had it in my refrigerator. I threw it away. So I haven't been eating it. Because it's oil. What can I say? It's oil. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, how do you tell if you don't have
I was feeding off of her.
You know that all foods have fats. So even fruit has a percentage of fat. So all whole foods have a mixture of carbohydrate, protein, and fat. So if you are eating enough calories, you will not be deficient in fat. You look at the elephant and the ape and the chimpanzee, they're eating lettuce and whatever, carrots.
Mostly vegetables.
They're eating vegetables. And are they suffering from a protein deficiency? Are they suffering from a fat deficiency? You do not actually have to eat you have to make special effort to get fat. It's in the food.
There's one question right here. Yes.
Did you have another question?
Yeah, I had another question. A situation with a family that had a girl that they took into their home. The girl came from a home that, regular life, Big Mac, that type of lifestyle, sit in front of the TV type of thing. She went into the home of an Adventist. So totally different lifestyle, very conservative lifestyle. The family ate no fat in their diet. The girl started to not thrive. So they started to add a little bit of oil into her diet and she started to thrive a little bit more. Is there a certain idea when oil will be necessary to be added in the diet? I mean, was it okay for that situation where that girl was not thriving? They were giving her nuts, they were giving her avocados, whole food forms of based oils. But the girl, she was getting thinner and thinner and thinner, four-year-old little girl losing weight.
It's difficult to know the exact situation, and I think there probably are situations that are, you know, different. And I'm not here to be the food police of anybody. I'm not going to inspect your plates or anything like that. In general, if you switch from the high fat, high meat, high processed food diet, and especially with a four-year-old, I can imagine she's not really relishing the food that she's having, so she's probably not eating enough in general. So that's usually what it happens, is when you're switching from this high concentrated diet to a low concentrated diet, you have to eat more food. The stomach has to stretch. You literally have to eat more. So that's really what it comes down to usually, is people aren't eating enough. That happened to me, so.
It's a reprogramming of the whole system, but.
Was there another question around here?
Yeah. We like to tell you this, and if there's no more questions, we're gonna have to cut, but the bottom line is this. We don't consider ourselves, when it comes to food, conservatives. We are revolutionaries. We are extremes. Why? But we're happily so, because we are both on a journey, as we said at the beginning. The standard is basically different than what we're trying. We're a little bit pushing the envelope here. But we are sharing it with you with gladness, because we have experienced the benefits of it. We don't know where we're going to get with this. We are also growing in the process, and we'd like to share. And some of you are already on that path, and we're glad. We've shared some meals, you know, with you guys. Thank you for that. And this is basically the reality. Okay, the standard, we're not the standard. We're the minority.
We're not the standard.
No, we're not the standard. We're actually...
We're learning.
We're learning. We consider ourselves nutrition innovators, in a sense. We would like to become eventually partnered with all these people, get in touch with them, we as professionals. But we're pushing the envelope here. But we both invite you to explore this boldly and go to the sources, because a lot of that makes sense. And that's why tomorrow is actually very, very important, because we will link the spiritual component. I mean, we're talking about our spiritual sense by nutrition. And, we're not going to go necessarily to Daniel, which is a very feasible, a well example, you know, of this relationship between the mind and what we put in our bodies. But we'll tell you some specific information with quotes by E.G. White and also some spiritual components straight from the Bible. And you'll see that we have a responsibility to put the best we can in our bodies. And that is the message. So tomorrow, please, it's going to be important. And it's going to be, I think, the most excited day, because it'll hopefully give you the whole view of this, the whole approach, not just from the physiological point of view, but the psychological and spiritual sense also of this. Let's have a prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, we are glad that the questions are brought. We want to learn more. We keep learning. We're exciting, because when we learn, the brain is aroused for new truths. And that is so exciting. That is revitalizing. It basically enhances our search for that which is you, the Creator. And so we want to go back to the source for the things that you have given us to maintain health despite of the sinful world we live in. And so that is wonderful news to us. Help us to search more, to find more truth out there in nature, to nurture ourselves with the best things we can, the best foods we can find, and share it with others that are in disease or perhaps lack information. Use us in many ways. Bring everybody safely tomorrow. Tomorrow is quite a spectacular day. We look forward to sharing with our brethren on the truths and the principles that you have given us. Prepare us for tomorrow, Lord. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.